Have you ever seen someone do really well and wonder how on earth they managed it? I've found myself asking that very question at times, and now I want to uncover the elements that go into creating success, influence, connection, and most importantly, happiness in people's lives. My friends, welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. Welcome one and all to another episode of the High Performance Human Podcast. It's your man Andy here, and I tell you what, and I keep saying this, right, Scott? I keep saying this at the start of every episode. I keep catching myself saying what an episode we've got on our hands and what a guest we've got on the show today. But team, you've got to believe me with this one. You've got to believe me because Scott Bateman, CEO of Colmio, which is a platform designed to create balance between every stakeholder in a relationship when it comes to renting property. So your tenants, your landlords, your property managers. Colmio is this software platform that is designed to make everyone's lives that little bit more smoother. And I tell you what, the journey that this lad's been on is something that I've been privy to by chance more than anything else. But even from the very first time that I met him as a property owner, the level to which I've been impressed by the way that he goes about his business, by the way that he goes about his life, his ethos, and I tell you what, he's a sharp cookie as well to boot. It's just so impressive, and I'm delighted to have him on the show. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. How the devil are you?
That is a pretty cracking welcome, Andy. Thank you so much. I am terrific, and I'm thrilled to be joining you.
Well, look, the pleasure is absolutely all mine, man. And team, one thing that you will notice straight away, and I want you to put this down in your notes immediately, is the fact that this guy has got a level of intellect, but you won't realize it. And that is a special, that is a fucking special talent to have. It really, really is, to be as clever as this guy is, and then for him to still make people like me feel half like I deserve to be in his presence is pretty phenomenal, right? So we're going to have a really, really good chat in this one. Now, team, with Scott's been through a bit of an evolutionary process, and him and his amazing better half, Lexi, who is a purveyor of tea, so she's instantly won my tick of approval. They are both individuals that take life on in the way that they want to take it on. They don't conform to the conveyor belt of life. And that's probably the biggest thing that instantly drew me to them as human beings. But the way in which Scott takes on a level of performance within life and business and whatnot is something that we've not really had a chance to talk about too much on this podcast up to this point. So I'm absolutely certain that you're going to get a really cool perspective on what High Performance Human looks like. But Scott, for the people that don't know who you are, just give us a little bit of a genesis on who you are and what got you to this point.
Sure. I'm Scott Bateman. I live in Melbourne. You mentioned my wonderful wife, Alexis, who is the love of my life and has been for the last 18 years. So I'm really fortunate to have a terrific marriage that I get to build a life around. I am, for work, I'm the CEO of a prop tech company called Colmio. We built this because we kind of came to this conclusion that renting is fundamentally broken. And I say that having been, you know, wrestling with housing security and homeless, a frustrated renter, a frustrated property investor. And I spent 5 years running the biggest property management company in the country, seeing firsthand that solving these problems is not as simple as or as easy as what we might hope it would be. So we went off, we built a tech company, and now we're rolling that out to a whole bunch of different property management businesses around the country. I am a perpetual student. As I said before, you know, I got kicked out of school and home when I was 15, so I certainly didn't look like your classic academic. I had this epiphany sort of in my 30s that I wanted to achieve more in life and get more out of life. Enrolled, did a couple of master's degrees, and then eventually found myself at Harvard Business School in late 30s. I was fortunate to be the youngest person in the world to get into that program. So I've kind of gone from literally no education to a pretty interesting one. And I think that served me pretty well in terms of both looking at things from a very pragmatic real world point of view, but also from an academic point of view, depending on what the situation meant.
You got kicked out of home when you were 15.
I did. Yeah, yeah.
If you don't mind, that surprised me. I didn't know that about you. And Tim, when you know he's mentioned Harvard Business School, just like in a breath. But to be the youngest person in the world to have been enrolled, enlisted, and completed that course, that's no small feat. So how 15, you get kicked out of home. Was it because you were a little asshole?
More or less.
Right. Okay.
I'm always like, my dad jokes that I was 18 when I turned 10. I only ever wanted to be a fighter pilot. Like it was the only job I ever wanted to do. And I had the grades and, you know, all of that was going well and I thought I would do it. When I turned 15, I called the Air Force to start the process to enroll. I had a history of asthma, chronic asthma when I was a child. So it wouldn't have mattered how good my grades were. The answer was no, you can never do this job. Mm. And for me, that was just life destroying. Like it was all I ever wanted to do. Mm. As a consequence, I started to lose interest in school. Started hanging around with some naughtier mates, found myself going to a bunch of illegal underage rave parties and all this sort of nonsense. And the next thing I know, all I wanted to do was DJ and run rave parties and festivals. So I quickly found myself with a group of people that, you know, my parents were not too pleased that I was spending time with. And we got to a point where it made sense for me to find my way out of home, so to speak. So an ideal sort of way to come into your adult life, but pretty good way of becoming an adult very quickly when you're sleeping on people's couches and sort of worried about where you're going to stay. And that went on for a couple of years.
And what did you, were you finding jobs? Were you sponging? Like how were you getting?
I became a chef, funnily enough. I had a job pumping petrol, which I was just doing part-time and it was my first job. Mm. And there was a guy that had at the time a BMW Z4, which I thought was very fancy and very cool. Mm. And I'd talk to him about his car while I filled up his car. He liked that this young kid made an effort to talk to him. He was opening a restaurant and said, well, what do you want to do? Would you want to be a chef? And I thought, well, not really, but I'm happy to give something a go and I need an income. So I started my apprenticeship as a chef and became a chef.
Right. And then how long were you chefing for?
Not long. So about 4.5 years, almost 5 years. And then one day the gentleman I was working for hadn't been paying his rent. The landlord came and locked everything up. With that went all of my knives and equipment and everything, so I couldn't work.
Right.
And I was kind of having this moment where I was thinking, I don't want to do this forever. Everyone I'm surrounded by is, divorced and on drugs, and it's not a good place to be. So I took a job doing outbound cold calling so I could learn how to sell. So I was living in Sydney. I was in Blacktown. I'd hop on a train every day to Chatswood, which for those that know is about a two-hour trip each way. I'd call 100 people a day trying to sell hotel loyalty memberships. Mm. I'd get, two, three on a good day saying yes out of the 100 telling me to fuck off.
Yep.
And then I'd go back home, and that was how I learned how to sell and got me out of hospitality.
This picture's getting a whole load more colourful real fast. Real fast. Right, okay. This is awesome, gang. Like, I'm discovering stuff here. This is mint. So you'd start doing outbound sales, and then because I've known you from your Bank of Melbourne days. And then... like to talk to you at that point in your life when you were doing some really good significant things with Bank of Melbourne. I would never have pictured you of having that history. I would never have picked it in a million years. And how some people they carry that sort of stuff like a bit of a badge of honor, but as a result of that badge of honor, they parade it, right? They tend to have that as their MO to have people pay attention to them and talk to them and so on and so forth. I get the sense, right, that you are very much a guy that lives in the present moment. Is that fair? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I have friends, several friends die at different times when I was younger. And it's one of those horrible things that forces you to very much kind of confront, what do I want from life? And am I being present? And am I, going after the things that I want? Or am I wallowing in what was?
Yeah.
Or trying to build an identity around my pain or whatever.
Exactly.
I'd rather just really focus on what do I want and what do I have to do to get it.
Yeah. No, and that's that, team, is something that you should be writing in your notes like straight away. Is, you know, our identity isn't defined by where we've been and what we've done and our battle scars and so on and so forth. Our identity is something that is always, is ever evolving. It has to always constantly evolve, because what you wanted 5 years ago is going to be different to what you want now. And therefore what you want naturally forms a part of your identity and your drive and your vision and your energy and where that energy goes and flows and so on and so forth. So that's the first thing that you need to take into your notes, 100%, team, that just because you settle on an identity doesn't mean that it needs to stay as that, which is a really interesting starting point. Now, like I said to you, gang, this is going to be an awesome chat, and we've already digressed, which is hilarious, and I can see it coming a mile up. But let's get back on track. Now, as I've mentioned at the top of all of these podcasts, I believe, Scott, that there are four pillars towards achieving a life as a high-performance human, being success, connection, influence, and happiness, and no one can survive without the other. Now, very interested to hear what your definition is of a high performance human.
It's a great question. Like, from my point of view, a high performance human is really clear about who they are, what they want from life, and the importance of the people around them as they go after whatever that is that they've defined. They are, by nature, people who make decisions in a really strategic and kind of calculated manner. They understand sacrifice and perseverance, and they're typically looking for growth and development and progress. There was a quote that one of my previous managers gave to me, which has always stuck with me, which he said, you know, the curse of the high performer is perpetual dissatisfaction. And it was a really interesting comment that by nature, high-performing people are never comfortable. And in some ways, that serves them well because they move very quickly and they progress. In others, it can get in your way because you are seemingly never satisfied. So I think there's that balance where we say, be clear about what you want and what you've got to do to get it, but at the same time, make space for gratitude and satisfaction too. Otherwise, all you'll ever do is chase and you'll never actually get the joy of whatever it is that you've achieved.
I really like that. Clarity is a very, very critical word. And that's not actually a word that many people that have come onto this show have used. A lot of people have said things along the lines of consistency and so on and so forth, and there's been some fascinating answers. But the word clarity, I think, is immensely powerful when we talk about, you know, looking to achieve a level of high performance in your life. Because obviously, high performance, guys, it's defined by your life. It's not defined by Instagram or whatever, right? So if you have a greater clarity into the landscape that is your world, then you by definition, you will have an automatic ability to be able to see the path ahead better than anybody else, because you could see the clarity of that path in your world and not get it mixed with anybody else's world.
So true.
I love that. That's really, really good clarity. Now, interestingly, and this is a really good little conversation I think we need to have, is I really, really like and also really hate that quote that you just said from your ex-boss, right? Because it is realistic. Let's be honest. There's a massive degree of truth to it, but it's riddled with negativity, right? And it sort of makes people go, well, fuck it. I'll just be a...
I think see it more as a challenge to the high performer rather than an observation of.
Right.
So it's not saying high performers are unhappy or anything like that. It's saying that high performing people by nature are so hungry, they're so driven, that the curse that comes with that is that you can fall prey to always kind of looking at what you've done and dismissing it and disregarding it because you move on to the next goal. So I think it's see it as a challenge. Like, if you want to go after these big lofty goals, do it. Absolutely do it. It's a great way to live your life and it's rewarding and so on. but make space and make time for the people around you to celebrate what you've achieved, to reflect. Like, it's all of those things that are just as important if you want that to be sustainable.
I think the language that we use around high performance is, I think that alone, though, can be a real barrier to entry, right? Mm. It can be a huge barrier to entry. Take the word curse, for example. No one likes to be cursed. I think that's safe to say. No one likes to be cursed. And yes, for the high performers, they will take that as a challenge. Mm. But for those that are sat on the sidelines that want to get into the game of high performance, they really, really struggle to interpret it in a productive way. Yes. It's an observation I've made is that a lot of the hurdles towards people believing that they can achieve high performance is the fact that high performers, the way that high performance articulate things like challenges and so forth, are seen as like just no entry. Mm. Oh, I don't want to do that. That sounds horrific. And therefore they sort of turn back and they go, well, how can I balance not having that by being settled here? And how can I justify this sort of, I don't want to call it mediocre existence, but that's in essence what it is when you look at some of the potential that just doesn't get tapped into by any human being. Right.
Yes, that's true.
So instead of using the word curse, team, maybe we could look at changing. And in if you are looking at how you would achieve a high level of performance, and you see words like that, and you see things that create a little bit of a shiver up your spine and whatnot, maybe have a think about how you can redefine that for yourself, because that's what high performers do automatically. Right? They will automatically go, right, cha-ching, right. You want to test me? I'll win. And that's how they roll. But for people that want to make that switch, maybe, for example, we take that word curse and exchange it for something like cost. What's the cost of me? Is the cost of me getting to that point in my life worth paying? Mm. Because then it becomes a little bit more tangible. Curses, but then you make you think of witchcraft and all this sort of shit, right?
I think there's a counter quote that I also love, which is, and I'll get the wording wrong, but the message is mm. right, which is one from Steve Jobs, where he talks about this epiphany in looking at the world around him and realizing that every single thing that exists has been built by people no smarter and no more capable than him. And it's a really interesting way to see the world around you, because whether that is digital things and technology things or physical things, big buildings and all these things, all of it is built by very normal people. Some smarter than others, some more capable than others, some more physically competent than others, but all just people. And I think when you start to see the world that way, you realize the possibility that's there as well.
Oh.
It's wonderfully exciting.
Oh, big time, big time. And that segues us into the first thing that I really want to have a chat about with you, because you are a prime example of that. You know, I'm not saying that you're just a normal bog standard human being, my friend, but I'm mindful that I don't want to just pin you as just a standard bloke. But the thing is, right, when you consider the upbringing and that late teenhood, early adulthood sort of phase that you went through, and the situations that forced you into growing up and what have you. There's plenty of people and lots of people that, and I don't want to use the word victim mentality, but lots of people that use those things as a reason as to why they can't step into the game of high performance for themselves. Right.
Yeah.
Now, one big thing that I've admired tremendously about yourself is your thirst for knowledge. And your thirst and that incessant need to keep advancing the big thing between your ears, right? And it is, man, he's got a massive brain, to be fair to him. So you mentioned that it was sort of in your 30s where you had that bit and you're like, shit, I want to get clever, right? What was it? Do you think, if you think back, where or what sort of triggered that within you? Or was it something that was always there, but you sort of pushed to the back because you didn't have the space, the time, the money, the resources, or whatever? Or is it a situation or a circumstance or a conversation that triggered that?
So the honest story is that because I left home when I did, I had this chip on my shoulder where I was going to prove the world wrong. And everything I was doing was just about, literally, it sounds terrible, but how do I measure myself against everyone else around me so that I can feel better and show the world, look at me, I earn more money, I'm more successful, whatever. Like it was pretty egotistical.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was interesting is that as I moved into the corporate world and I started working for banks and insurers and groups like that, increasingly imposter syndrome set in because mm-hmm. I'm in rooms with really smart people having, you know, conversations about huge sums of money and complex topics. And they would ask you, they'd point to you and they say, what's your position on this? What's your take? And it wouldn't matter what words came out of my mouth. I just felt like an idiot. And I'm like, at any moment, I'm going to get found out here because I'm a fraud. You know, they don't know that I never even finished high school.
Mm.
So this kind of burning desire to prove the world wrong met this interesting feeling of, oh, my God, I'm a fraud. And at the same time, I was looking to propose to my now wife, Lex. So I went and booked this incredibly elaborate, hotel thing in Santorini, and it was all very cool.
Mm.
And I didn't end up proposing there, but when we got there, we're sort of sitting there and I'm like, I actually want a life where this is normal and it's not a one-off because I'm trying to propose.
Mm.
And you know what? I've got to deal with this imposter syndrome. So still driven by money and greed, but I've got to deal with this imposter syndrome. Fuck it. When I get back, I'm all in. Like it doesn't matter how stupid I feel. I'm going to try and get into an MBA. I'm going to start my study. And I'm going to become a CEO by the time I'm 40. So this is when I was just turning 30. So it wasn't, none of it was for the right reason, like absolutely none of it.
Mm.
When I got into my MBA, suddenly I found, you know, I'd chat with really smart people and I'd say, hey, I feel like you twit. Like, I don't even know how to write a report. I don't know how to write an essay. I never finished school. And they're like, don't worry, just give it your best. We'll help you. So immediately you get this sense that people actually do want to help you.
Mm.
And then when I'd say to them, I've got this horrible sense of always feeling like a fraud, they kind of laughed and they went, you know, everyone does. You know, some of them are PhDs or they're, you know, masters in other areas. And they're like, every one of us in different situations still feels like that. Like, that's not unique to you dropping out of school. That's just a human problem. So what was interesting is that through that process, as I learned more about myself, I started to care a lot less about money, a lot less about title. I lost that chip on my shoulder and I got a lot clearer about who I am, what I want from life, what actually matters and where I want things to end up. And started making fundamentally different decisions. So that urge to be successful hadn't gone. That urge to advance my life hadn't gone. That curiosity and thirst for knowledge hadn't gone. But it was all now in aid of a very different goal, which was how do I live a really fulfilling life, not how do I prove the world wrong? So I sort of completed a couple of degrees, moved out of the banks. So I got approached by Headhunter to join Paul Little's real estate business and started my career in real estate. And then through that, I had an opportunity after a little while where we were getting ready to sort of shape up the business plan for what is now Commio. And he sort of said, well, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know what? I've got this dream to study at Harvard that came about when I was doing my MBA. I'd love to apply. And if I can get in, would you sponsor it? And he was willing to do so. So luckily, I put in my application, went through the process. I got in when I was 36. I think the average age of people is 55. Finished it when I was 37 and came back to be the CEO of Commio. So it's kind of this strange evolution where all the wrong reasons put me on a terrific path and I just got lucky that the right reasons came about through that process.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Rita, Real Estate Training Australia. Shane and the team genuinely care for the success of all of their students. Not only providing them with the qualifications to enter the industry, but the skills in order to thrive. With 24-hour online support, access to one-on-one training sessions, lifetime access to industry mentors and support, as well as free job-ready training programs for anybody that gets their qualifications through their portal. They're a tremendous outfit, and they want to make sure that everybody that comes into the industry stays in the industry. For more information, make sure you head to their website, www.reta.com. www.ecc.edu.au.
See, yeah, I love that. I love that. And you've clearly given yourself a chance to have a think about all this and reflect on all of this sort of stuff, which you have to do. Because I've had that chip on the shoulder syndrome of wanting to prove people wrong and what have you. And it was actually the start of my real estate career where the chip on my shoulder was everyone thinks real estate agents are arseholes chip.
Yep.
Right. Yep. And they're all con men and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, people walk across the street to avoid talking to you and all sorts of stuff because you've got a real estate agent. And coming from a hospitality background where everybody wants to be friends with you, because you're running a bar in London or whatever. Right. I took that really hard. You know, I've really struggled with that shit. So that chip on the shoulder, it drives you to a point. And you hear this a lot on social media and whatnot from these influencers and these loud people that you need to prove people wrong, that you need to have a chip on your shoulder and all this sort of stuff to drive you to do well and blah, 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 blah. But fuck me, it doesn't half make you miserable.
It's not sustainable. That's the problem.
No.
Like it'll get you going. It's good for getting you going, but it doesn't last. Like that, eventually you run out of energy, setbacks, you just don't keep overcoming them in the same way. That chip doesn't last.
And the negative connotations around it make problems feel bigger as well.
Well, it's lonely. Like if it's you against the world, that's a pretty shitty, lonely spot to be in.
Yeah.
If it's you advancing your life and wanting to bring others in and around that with you, that is a wonderful space to be in. And it's the same work, it's the same process, it's the same challenges, but the reward is completely different, assuming you're successful in proving the world wrong, which will never happen, versus building something that's really meaningful and purposeful.
Yeah, but you're absolutely spot on. It's like we can't change the world, but we can certainly change our world.
And I love that
you sort of touched on that. Now, going into what you mentioned before about you talked about that fraud thing, and you said that other people around you laughed and said, everybody feels it. And before that, you mentioned that it sort of surprised you at first as to the number of people that were actually willing to help.
Yeah.
Now, I had this out to a degree with Dr. Sarah Bell. And we talked about this whole obsession with self, whatever, right? You know, self-improvement, self-awareness, self this, self that, self the other. And my counterpoint to some of the stuff that she said was, humans by definition, we're not self anything. Yeah. We are pack animals, and you know, we do need each other. You know, you look at anybody that's achieved anything, and it's come through an interdependent existence, right? You know, utilizing the strengths and skills of other people and whatnot to complement theirs. From your side of things, why do you think you were surprised that people were as willing to help you as what they were? Is it born through the fact that up till that point ish, you were looking at it as fighting through adversity?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
And I think so. I mean, like up until that point, from my point of view, anytime I'd relied on someone, that someone had not come through.
Right.
So your perception of people in the world is shaped by a few, but really meaningful negative experiences. So when I rely on someone, it doesn't go well. When I do it myself, you know, I'm in control. So you build this kind of muscle around just do it yourself, do it yourself, do it yourself. When I got into the NBA and I rocked up on my very first day there, I was shitting bricks. I was so nervous. I was so embarrassed. I'm sitting in this room full of really smart people listening to these incredibly smart professors just going, holy shit, what have I done? And how the hell do I get out of this? Because I shouldn't be here. And, you know, I was put in a group assignment on the first day, and that's when I said to these guys, listen, I'm going to level with you. I will work like crazy, but this is where I'm starting from. And I kind of just was roll the dice. Like, if they knock me back, then so be it. My worst fears are true, and off I go. I just can't do this. But luckily for me, they were amazing people, and most people that I've met along the way tend to be very similar. And it's interesting. There's a book called The Go-Giver as opposed to The Go-Getter, and it talks about, or it's a fictional story, but telling the story of this guy that, you know, comes to realize the power of giving first. And one of the principles within the book that I've personally really struggled with, which I think talks to your point, is this notion of reciprocity. So we find it easy to give. We find it really difficult to take and to receive. And the problem with that is, if we all just want to give and no one's willing to take, no one can give. So as much as we get a lot of joy and personal reward and from being selfless and helping others, many of us actually really struggle with accepting someone doing something nice for us. And we see it all the time. Like, I took my parents on a trip overseas a few years ago, and you could see how much they struggled with accepting that as a gift from me. And it was hard, because all I wanted to do was give them this thing. And my dad sort of said to me, "Mate, I would love to do the same for you, but I struggle to take this from you." And so I think we are all naturally wired that way, where we find it easier to give than we do to receive.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a helplessness in it. There's a guilt or an embarrassment in it. Look, we're really complex creatures. And I think, when we do something for others, there's a bit of status and power without us kind of even realizing it, potentially, where we give up status in someone else giving something to us. We look at, all of the science and the leadership as a topic. Inevitably, what it comes down to is, going back to our kind of cave people roots, we will defer to someone else, which is leadership, when we feel like that person knows what's important to us and they are more capable of helping us get it than we would be on our own. That's it. That's how tribal leadership emerged. It's how corporate leadership emerged. And if you look at where leadership typically goes wrong, the follower has had this realization that the leader doesn't know what matters to them or isn't actually more capable of helping them get it than that person doing it alone. So this whole evolution over time, I think we've become accustomed to this kind of dynamic where, as soon as I'm taking something from someone, it's like, am I less than? Do I owe this person something? Shouldn't I be able to do this for myself? Like, there's all of those silly feelings that creep up.
It is an odd one, isn't it? It's almost, I think you've sort of on the money there. I think it's an admission of a weakness, almost. Yeah.
Vulnerable.
It's like, even if it's something like super special, like a holiday or a gift or a car or something like that, right? The fear that comes with accepting that is, it's a false admission. It's a false admission. It's a perceived admission that they're getting that for you because you couldn't afford it yourself.
Spot on.
And it's not even and I'm just thinking back to some of the shit that I've been bought. And I'm thinking, I feel bad. I feel bad taking buddy a $20 gift voucher or something like that, right? And it's not like I can't afford $20 myself, but for some reason, in that moment, I feel like a bit of a div because I'm like, I could have just got that myself, you don't need to worry about that. And it's just stupid. What a silly little chemical reaction that we have to that.
Put yourself in your grandparents' position. For anyone whose grandparents still give them $20 or $50 or something in a card at a birthday or Christmas, you clearly earn more money than they do. You clearly have more money than they do, but it is so important to them to be able to do that for you.
Yeah.
So we take it. We don't need it, but we take it because we know that's important to them. And the joy they get from being able to say, I've given this thing. It's a really interesting thing. But again, a lot of us, we're far better at giving than we are at receiving.
And when you look at it with that grandparent example, we have a responsibility to be better at receiving stuff.
So true.
Because of the role that we are not allowing, but kind of that we are accepting on the other side. Like we're in that dynamic, we know that the give and take is not the thing. It's the emotions and the energy and the chemical reactions that are going on behind the thing.
So true.
And so we almost have a responsibility as humans to be better at receiving stuff because of the give and take that happens in human dynamics and human relationships. And it's just as important, you could suggest. Everybody talks about generosity and so on and so forth, you know, giving of your time, giving of your energy, give, like go giver, right? You know, go be a go giver. But I think we really perhaps as a society need to actually look at this whole receiving thing for the level of importance that it has. Because you can't be a giver if no one receives it.
Spot on.
We've really got to have a look at that. That's going to be interesting. I'm going to have a dig into that later. And gang, I think from your side of things, maybe if you're listening in, maybe give yourself a second to marinate on this point that Scott and I have kind of half stumbled on, which is that if you feel guilty about receiving presents and so on, it could even be compliments. That is my
advice. Could be time, could be anything. Yep.
Compliments is the thing that fucks with me. Right? It really, really does mess with my head. It really does. I can't handle it. My partner, she gets real shitty when she'll pay me she'll pay me a nice compliment. And to her, it's her being nice, right? Yeah. And so that when I struggle to accept it, it's almost a perceived rejection of said energy, which then gets me in shit. Right? So, so we've got a responsibility to our fellow humans to be much better at receiving stuff, friends. What a cool little thing to write down in your notes, which I wasn't expecting out of this conversation. It's always good to find those little ones, right? It's always good to find them little golden nuggets on the way through. Now, you said a phrase that segues us into the next thing that I really wanted to talk about with you, which was when you said that you rolled the dice and jumped headfirst into an MBA, right? Having watched you from a short distance in terms of your trajectory, your changes, your movements, your education, the environments you've been in, the conversations that you've thrown yourself into, it's clear that you have a good pair of minerals on you, right? You've got an ability to roll the dice and have the balls to give something a crack. When Scott and I caught up with each other briefly at a conference that we were both involved in, and Scott was giving us the lowdown on the risk factors that came financially, if nothing else, that came with the growth and the formation of Colmio and what have you, and the real challenges in the early phases of that. Talk to me about having the balls to give something a crack. Now, when it comes to these sorts of decisions or these sorts of opportunities, shall we say, before you've even made the decision, do you get nervous?
Oh, of course. You shit yourself. I still shit myself. Like, talking about Colmio, like Colmio's been the hardest thing I've ever done by far, like not even close. It's so, so challenging. And we're fortunate that things are in really good shape now, but that's 4 years of pain and challenge and fear and literally every day sort of going, what have I done? Like, have I blown a bunch of people's money? Have I made life too difficult for customers? Am I misleading my team? Like, there's all those questions that go through your mind. Now, those questions are getting less and less as you kind of build a pattern of success and build a bit of time. But even today, like every day, there's something that pops up where you go, what have I missed or what am I missing? Or, you know, you reflect on a decision and question whether you've made the right call. There's all of that. That just never, ever stops. Mm. The problem is, I think people don't do things because they're fearful that those are going to be problems and things are going to solve. Until you get comfortable taking some risk with some of that, the one thing that you can guarantee is that you will go nowhere. You can absolutely guarantee it. So the question becomes one of calculation. What's the risk of doing this new thing? And what's the risk of staying the same? And if we really work out what staying the same means over time, generally it's not particularly appealing. There's reasons to do it from time to time, but generally long-term, I don't want to go 10 years and look back and go, what if? I'd rather struggle and fight and do what I need to do, knowing there's some risk that things will go wrong. Now, that said, we make really calculated decisions on what we do. There's I don't know, maybe 100 things that pop up that we consider and don't do for every one thing that we consider and do. So it's not just firing from the hip and diving into things. There's a lot of analysis and all of that stuff. But ultimately, it only gets you so far. It doesn't matter what it is. You've just got to get to a point where you weigh it up and go, what's the risk of doing it? What's the risk of staying exactly where I am? And often that's the thing that kind of gets you to go, all right, well, let's just have a go and bring in the people that we need to bring in and see what we can do.
When we talk about shitting ourselves, right, and we look at the risk factors and so on and so forth, a lot of people that really struggle with risk and taking chances, like you mentioned, they will use that as a not a barrier to entry, just as a shut door, a closed door, a locked door that they can't get through. When we're processing these risks in our heads, is it fair to say, or would you think that this might be close to the mark, to say that these risks that we are in many instances exacerbating in our heads, amplifying to, you know, become the Goliath of problems, the ones that can take the risk despite that, is it almost like they have a subconscious understanding that the risks that they are looking at are essentially first world risks and not risks that are going to affect their health? It's not going to kill them. It's not, you know, it's not like the risks that cave people had, right? Where they step out of the cave and it's life or death.
You're gone.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's a big nasty thing. And I've just got, because with the two kids, I've just got the Croods ringing in my ears now. The risk back in the day, and the only real risks, I'm going to call them real risks, shall we say. The real human risks are the ones that are life and death risks. You could argue.
Yeah.
And every other risk that we have a problem with can be therefore attached to ego in the sense of not a case of, you know, fear of failure or whatnot. But a lot of the time, these risks are connected to things that we don't want to lose in our first world, in our first world existence.
Yeah.
From your point of view, and I'm just trying to piece a couple of bits of the puzzle of the Scott Bateman together, based on the fact that you essentially were couch surfing at 15 and, you know, didn't have a pot to piss in. Have you got a bit of a detachment from material things? Do you have that in the correct order of importance in your head, do you think? And therefore that helps you to take some of these risks as opposed to what a lot of people can't do because of the priority sort of order of things in their life. Do you think that's close to the mark, maybe?
Yeah, it's a really insightful observation. So there's a couple of things that have shaped me. One is when I was growing up, my father had a business that went broke. It was horrible. And when he got back on his feet and started another business, I remember sitting with him one day and he was chatting with me and said to me, you've got to understand all of this, pointing to the house and the car and the things that were going well at the time. He said, none of it matters. And you've got to be prepared to give all of it up and just get back up on your feet and go again. Because at the end of the day, that's what matters is life will happen. So get attached to the process and get attached and keep family close, but don't worry about all this other shit. Like, it's nice to have, but don't make it your whole life. As a consequence, I'm pretty fortunate. We do pretty well. We live pretty well. But if I had to give it all up tomorrow, I'd give it all up. Like, we just kind of start again and off we go.
Apart from the rotty.
Mate, no one's coming for the dog. my beautiful big sook of a thing. But I've always had a chronic fear of failure. Like in many ways, my fear of failure was what motivated me to you know, keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing where others would quit because I was so determined not to fail that I was doing really unhealthy things, to be honest. So that's there. What I found, though, is that as I went and did study and as I got, the different jobs that I got, the sense of confidence that I have that if it all went horribly wrong that I would land on my feet went up considerably. So that is like when people talk about like a degree's worth it and all this sort of stuff, for some people, I'm sure they're probably not worth the price tag. But for me personally, that sense of confidence that if this all breaks, I've got a plan B was incredibly helpful in going, all right, I can afford to take a punt.
And that kind of goes, against a lot of the common vernacular of that suggests that having a plan B makes you soft.
Yeah.
You know, having a plan B makes you soft in the sense of it makes people, you know, if you have a plan B, it means that you're not going to be all in on plan A. But it's a really interesting point that you make there, because you felt that because you had that fallback, it means that you could just swing the bat freely, go for a home run, because you know you're going to get, you know, you've got another chance. And it's interesting, right? Because, and I think that probably ties in with why a lot of people really struggle with this risk thing, because of the fact that common vernacular suggests that they need to be all in, plan A or nothing. And therefore, it does then become a much closer version, modern world, first world version of life and death.
Yeah. Well, that notion, like, for, you know, we talk about the expression of burning the boats, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with where that came from, but, you know, like the idea that for those that don't know, like a navy landed on the shores to fight a war. The commander decides he's going to burn the boats so that this navy, grossly undernumbered, is going to fight like crazy because there's no retreat. They know if they don't win, they'll die on the beach. It's literally do or die. And you'll often hear the expression used to tell people, like, you've got to be all in, you've got to burn the boats, all this shit. It's cool. Like, if something is life and death, that's true. That's the right approach. For almost everything else, that is exactly the wrong advice. Because we start weighing up, you know, the options and the possibilities and upside and downside and all of that in this grossly inaccurate way, thinking that if this one path I'm on doesn't pay off, everything is over. I would encourage people to think like a software company, to be honest, which is do a thing, prove that that thing is going in the way that you hope, and then take your next little step. What's the next smallest step I can take to give me confidence I'm on the right path, or de-risk, whatever it might be? And each time I take a little step, any failure is a little step back. You're not going back to the start. And every time I make progress, it's another little step forward, and I get to take a little bit more risk with the next thing that might come. So it's quite iterative. So I'd say do that, not burn the boats.
Yeah. And I think what great little bit of advice that is for your team to put into your notes. Like, you've got to, when we're talking about calculated risks and so on and so forth, two things. Before we wrap this thing up, because Scott's been phenomenal in the giving of his time. The first thing is that we can conclude from that part of the conversation is that if you are that concerned about whether you take a punt on something or whether you take a risk or give something a crack, have a real concerted thought process as to what you are prioritizing in your life that's causing you that fear of loss. And is the thing that you are fearing losing actually going to be, in reality, that detrimental to your life, right? That's point one. But what Scott just said there is profound, in the sense that you can mitigate that sense, that fear of loss, if you break the risk down into smaller chunks, if you break the risk down into smaller patterns of progress, is the word iterative is it's a beautiful word, and that implies, team, that if you just take very small incremental steps forward, then you mitigate risk, and the fallback position isn't half as far back as what you hope, as what you worry it could be. Which is, it's kind of like free climbing, right? It's kind of like rock climbing is free climbing, right? I mean, every time I see one of them videos, I don't think you've got a fear of heights. And then I watch one of them and I go, fuck me. But they take a couple of little steps and then they bang one of them pegs into the rock so that if they do fall, it isn't a massive one. It's a little fall. And I think if you take that free climbing approach to risk, then you're going to be in a much better, much more safer mindset. And therefore you're going to have a confidence to move forward. Now, Scott, man, we could talk for hours and hours and hours and provide so much value to, because you're just such a good bloke in every sense of the word. I want to ask you the one thing though. that you think is missing from yourself when it comes to your version of high performance? This is a question that I've started, that I've been rounding podcast off with, and I'm really interested to hear, because you are so transparent in your approach and your learning and in your and it's just so amazing. So from your side of things, and this is not what Alexis would think, this is what Scott. I'm pretty confident they'd be two different things. For sure. What is the one thing missing from you right now when you look at what your version of high performance is in your world?
The thing for me is that I've got a bunch of really brilliant people around me. So I'm fortunate that in my role, you know, it's my executive team that does most of the work across the business day to day. The problem I have is still in handing things off, letting them own it and letting them grow so that I'm almost irrelevant. You know, if for those that have read things like Jim Collins' Good to Great, where he talks about a level 5 leader and a level 4 leader, the number one thing that makes level 5 that most businesses never get to is that whoever supersedes the leader is better than the leader that was there because of the work that leader did. For me, I've still got to do a lot of work to get better at making the team really capable of replacing me so that I can get out of that and do something else. Mm. Too often when I think about high performance, it's still what I'm personally involved in or, you know, whatever. I've got to get better at saying, well, actually, I'm part of a bigger whole and I'm just a part of that bigger whole. How do I increasingly step out of it and through the work that I do with others, elevate them so that they can do it instead? So I think that's kind of the next piece that I'm going to keep working on.
Fascinating stuff from a fascinating guy, to be perfectly honest, team. And as I'm sure you guys feel this as well, I feel very privileged and grateful that you've come onto this fair podcast of ours and just give us, just like I said, team, at the start of this episode, the level of intellect and intelligence is beyond dispute, but the way in which Scott runs his life and broadcasts his life is done with a level of, I don't want to use the word humility because I think that's overused now, but it's done with a level of acceptance as to who he is. And that, gang, is just priceless. It really, really is. And it's something that I respect and admire and really try and use as an example for myself more regularly than what Scott realizes. And I think there's lots of people that do that, to be honest. So Scott Bateman, thank you so, so much for joining us. Team, if you want to know more about Scott, we'll be posting links to him and the work that he does in the show notes. So make sure you have a bit of a clicky click and go and follow him and see what he's all about, because he provides plenty of value, particularly on LinkedIn. He provides a good degree of value. If you want to get to know the dog, then you might want to try and attach him. You might want to try and attach to him on different platforms, but it's well worth doing anyway, to be honest. So Scott, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your time, man, on the High Performance Human Podcast. And please make sure that you come back and visit us again sometime soon.
I definitely will. Thanks so much for having me.
Team, stay safe, healthy, happy. As always, I wish you all the very best, and I look forward to catching you on the next episode of the High Performance Human Podcast. Until then, look after yourselves, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the High Performance Human. Hopefully, we've given you enough value to justify the time that you've given us, and we've got you that much closer to becoming your version of a high performance human. If you want to have any questions answered, then please feel free to shoot me a DM on Instagram at Andy Reid Coaching, or alternatively, shoot me an email, andy@andyreid.com.au. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel. Thank you so much for joining us once again, and I really can't wait to hopefully bring you some more value in the next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, most importantly, stay happy.